Hi, thanks very much, Steve, for that. What I'm going to talk today about is I'm going to cover some of the stuff I talked about last week when I talked about what's gone on in the funding of the Australian banking system, and cover some of the points around that, which will then take into a bit of a discussion about the changing composition of capital flows in the country, which is reflective of that, and then talk a little bit about the exchange rate. Let me start with bank funding. So, as you may be aware, we published an article a couple of weeks ago now on the structure of bank funding, or the Australian funding of the Australian banking system. We've done that for a few years now, at least once a year, and we generally do provide most of that information each quarter in our statements on monetary policy. But for those of you who are domestic, you'll have some idea about why we put that out. For those of you who are not from Australia, the funding and the cost of funding for the Australian banking system is a very topical issue. Actually, this may be again of a surprise to people who come from outside Australia. It's generally front page news on a fairly frequent basis. And consequently, the discussion around bank funding costs can actually get pretty confused at times. It's often unclear whether a participant is referring to movements in levels of costs or in spreads, and if latter, what exactly the spread is relative to. The funding of the Australian banking system is interesting from a macro point of view, although, as I'll talk about a bit later, I think the scrutiny there is less than it needs to be. But also, particularly if you're interested in the profitability of the Australian banking system, then the cost of its raising its funds is obviously interest too. The main points I want to bring out from the article I put out a couple of weeks ago and that I talked about last week is notwithstanding movements in various risk premia and competitive pressures, the level of cash rate that the Reserve Bank Board sets each month is still the primary determinant of the funding costs and lending rates of the banking system in Australia. Obviously, things like risk premia and competitive pressures move around and they're not directly affected by the cash rate. But notwithstanding that, when the Reserve Bank Board moves the cash rate up or down, the whole structure of funding costs tends to move or does move up or down with it. Over the past year or so, at least since the middle of last year, the funding costs for the Australian banking system have fallen in absolute terms, so the levels are down. The spreads are up, particularly if you benchmark them relative to the cash rate, and spreads have risen quite noticeably. And one thing which I think is generally underappreciated is that most of that pressure is coming from the deposit side of things. So deposit pricing is where been most of the major driver of changes in funding costs over the past 9 months or so. So while wholesale spreads have moved out a long way, and I'll talk about that in a minute, it's actually the competition for deposits which has had the most material effect on the cost of funding. The movement in wholesale spreads has broadly reflected that of the global banking system. So if you think around the middle of last year, well, since the middle of last year, funding markets sort of dried up towards the end of last year, spreads went up a long way, probably would have gone up even higher if anyone had actually issued and found out where those spreads were, but by and large, no one did. Issuance picked up in the beginning of this year, but it very high spreads and have come down quite noticeably since. So notwithstanding the fact that spreads have narrowed a long way over, since January, they're still obviously higher than they have been over the past couple of years. So I'll just talk about those things in a little more detail. In terms of, as I said, the cash rate is still the primary determinant of movements in banks' funding costs and lending rates. But the Reserve Bank Board, as it said repeatedly, takes into account the fact that risk premia and competitive pressures move around. And so, by and large, it tries to offset the effect of those movements in the other costs of funds. And so that we end up with a level of lending rates, which is about where, or level of interest rates more generally, which is consistent with the desired stance of monetary policy. I think one thing to bear in mind, in all of this discussion, is that the link between the cash rate and lending rates in Australia is much tighter than it is pretty much anywhere else in the world. So in the US for the moment, movements in the Fed funds rate, if you can remember when those things actually occurred, but anyhow, when they did occur, they had a much less direct influence on the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So there's a hell of a long way between the overnight rate and the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, lot less, much tighter link between the movement in our cap, in the cash rate here and movement in lending rates in Australia, given that most of mortgages in Australia and business loans for that matter are variable rate or at most 3-year fixed rate. Let me talk a bit about how the composition of the Australian funding of the Australian banking system has changed over the past few years. So since 2007, the share of deposit funding has risen from 40% to about 52% now. So a bit over a 12 percentage point rise in the share which has gone to deposits. By and large, that has been mirrored by a decline in short-term wholesale funding, so less than 1 year, which has fallen by from 30% to 20%. There's been a slight increase in long-term wholesale, and within the long-term wholesale side of things, there's been a terming out as well, so the maturity has tended to increase. As I said, so the major shift, and I'll talk a bit about covered bonds in a minute, but they're obviously only a very new part of the bank's funding structure, and so a small share currently, although likely to rise to somewhere around 5 or 6% over the next few years. Within banks' deposit funding, however, then it's something again which is sort of hasn't been noticed that much. There's been a marked shift towards term deposits. So term deposits have gone from about 30% of overall bank deposit books up to around 45% now. So you think deposits have gone from 40% to 50 something percent. Term deposits have gone from 30% to 45%. So term deposits are a major driver of the cost of the banks funding their books. And that's where a lot of the cost pressure has come from. A couple of things are going on there. One is that corporates, which are reasonably flush with cash at the moment in Australia, have been putting their money on term deposit. Now, if you go back a few years, they generally held that in the form of short-term wholesale paper. So if I was a corporate treasurer and I had a bit of spare cash, I'd buy a three-month bank bill. Now I pick up a 3 or 4 month term deposit and get paid more for it actually. What that means is that when you look at the composition of funding of the Australian banking system, some of it is just a rebranding. So the corporate, it's the same from the investor point of view, it's the same person. It's the same corporate treasurer investing with the same bank, just in a slightly different product. Same with the superannuation sector. So the superannuation sector in Australia never used to hold deposits with the banking system. Now they hold a non-trivial amount. And again, the superannuation system used to hold a lot of its exposure to the banking system in short-term bank paper. They've now switched that to term deposits. So when you look at that change in composition I was talking about, a lot of it is just a change in name. I mean, they are getting paid for more for it too, so that's why they're switching. But if you think about one of the reasons why banks are doing this, shifting from short-term paper to deposits, is because deposits are safer. Well, it's the same person making the same decision from the investor point of view. So it doesn't strike me there's been a major shift there in terms of, you know, I think emphasises the point that you need to look at the behaviour of the investor, not necessarily the product they're actually investing in terms of working out how stable a particular funding base is. From the bank's point of view, term deposits have the advantage of being a pretty stable funding source. So the average contractual maturity is somewhere between 4 and 7 months for a term deposit. But they're generally rolled over a number of times, so the effective maturity is actually around a few years. So a person will tend to stay with the same bank, roll the term deposit a number of times before they take the money out. From the bank's point of view, the structure the rate structure can be adjusted pretty quickly to achieve changes in their funding mix if they need to in a short period of time. And one problem with that, because the maturity structure is relatively short, when they change that pricing structure, it flows through very quickly to their funding. And that's been particularly true recently when the competition for deposits at the end of last year, partly or to a large extent reflecting the dislocation in global markets, ramped up a lot. Banks kept their deposit rates pretty high, and that caused that flowed through to their overall cost of funding fairly quickly. So taking account of all of that, our best estimate is that while the absolute level of banks' funding costs fell from the middle of last year to now, it's been much less than the reduction in the cash rate. And the major drivers have been term deposits and long-term wholesale debt. So in terms of deposits, so while the cash rate has fallen by 50 basis points, our estimate is that deposits have fallen. The cost of deposit funding has fallen by about 25. So in other words, relative to the cash rate, deposit funding has gone up by about 25 basis points. Talk a bit about wholesale debt and what's going on there. So, as I said, towards the end of last year, term wholesale markets were pretty dislocated. Spreads, to the extent you could see them, were very wide. This was a global phenomenon, not a local phenomenon. I think there were a few things going on there. Obviously, there was fear of Europe caused that dislocation. I think there was also that fear of Europe combined with the fact that we were near the end of the calendar year, meant that investors were basically happy to keep their hands in their pockets through the last quarter of last year. If you were in front, you wanted to stay in front, and if you were behind, you didn't want to get any further behind. But seemingly come the turn of the new year, obviously things in Europe looked a lot better after the ECB's LTRO, but also I think the sheer fact that we rolled the calendar forward into 2012 meant that investors were willing to take a bit more risk again. So you saw issuance pick up in January. The Australian banks issued a reasonable amount in January, I think somewhere around 30-40% of global bank issuance in the month of January, but at fairly wide spreads. They started issuing covered bonds again at fairly what looked pretty wide spreads. So there was a large domestic covered bond issued in January at spreads which were basically the same or wider than where unsecured issuance had been of the same maturity a few months earlier. And just, you know, in theory at least, you've got a lot better protection with a covered bond than you have with unsecured issuance. But since then, as you're probably all aware, spreads have come in quite markedly. So again, if I take covered bonds as an example, we had one last week, 4 years, not 5 year maturity, but it was a good 50, 60 points narrower or tighter than where issuance had been earlier in the year. And that's been seems to be true pretty much across the whole curve. So the pressure which is coming through in terms of funding costs from wider wholesale spreads has certainly backed off a bit. The other thing, given the Australian banks issue some offshore, is that while they'd been issuing, no one else had been issuing. In particular, European supers had not been issuing much into Australia at the beginning of this year, which meant that the basis was quite wide. Now, the kangaroo issuance has picked up a lot in the past month or so, and that's seen the basis start to come in again, and the Australian banks haven't been issuing quite so much. So, again, that dynamic is also working to alleviate some of the cost pressures. One thing to bear in mind, though, when you're looking at the wholesale funding cost side of things, is the average maturity of the book somewhere around 4 years. So it takes a while to actually roll through all those higher funding costs to the current stock. So notwithstanding, in fact, we've had a fair amount of issuance since the beginning of the year. It's only about 1/8 of the banking system's overall stock of outstanding debt. So it's taking a while for that repricing to come through, which means there's still a bit more to come. Just in terms of the short-term wholesale debt, I mentioned that term deposits are a bit of a swing variable in terms of the banking system, you know, meeting short-term needs for funding. But so is short-term wholesale debt. So when the offshore markets were dislocated, onshore short-term debt issuance tends to pick up, which means that if you look at the bill's OIS spread, for instance, you've got two things going on there. One, risk aversion's up, which means that spread tends to go up. Secondly, issuance is higher, so more supply means that the spread's going to widen too. So at times of market dislocation, there are sort of two factors driving that bill's OIS spread wider, and it was wider in the last quarter of last year. That's narrowed quite considerably again since, because those two factors are both reversed. Markets are a happier place now, so the risk spread has come in, and the fact that the banks have been able to issue term means that they've been able to roll down their issuance of short term, and that's pulled that spread back down. So it's now back around 30 basis points. Now, because a lot of the term products price off bank bill swap, that also has a material effect on the overall cost of funding. And to a reasonable extent, that provides a sort of indicator as to where the term deposit pricing is going to. The term deposit's now a lot more expensive relative to short-term wholesale debt, but in the broad scheme of things, they tend to move together. And one thing which I find somewhat interesting is that if you think about three-month bank paper, it's a tradable instrument with liquidity. Term deposit, not tradable. I mean, liquidity is sort of not relevant. Term deposits pay you a lot more than a tradable liquid instrument. And yeah, but that again reflects just the fact that one's called a deposit and the other one's called short-term wholesale. Okay, let me just talk a bit about what all that means in aggregate. So our best guess is that since the middle of 2007, banks' funding is about 120, 130 basis points wider relative to the cash rate. So if you think absent any change in lending rates, and there would have been 100, it's sort of 120, 130 basis points pressure coming through on margin there. Now obviously, the banks have moved lending rates and recouped basically the bulk of that. So their margins have tended to move in a reasonably narrow range over the last couple of years. Since the middle of 2011, our estimate is that funding costs have gone up about 20, 25 basis points relative to the cash rate. And again, obviously, some of that. A reasonable chunk of that has come, that's been recouped in movements in lending rates. So let me move that shift in the funding of the banking system into developments which have gone on the capital flows into Australia. So for a long period of time, there used to be the common story was that the banks fund the current account. They used to say that, they said that themselves, actually. Which mostly reflected the fact that if you looked at the size of the Australian current account deficit, it was about the same size as the capital flows into the Australian banking system. I've talked about this a few times in the past, but I don't find that a particularly helpful way of looking at things, because the current account is the net of a whole bunch of very large numbers. And similarly on the capital account side, it's also the net of a whole bunch of large gross flows. So it is true that the gross flows into the Australian banking system happen to move fairly much in line with the movements in the current account for more than a decade. But over the last 3 or 4 years, that has certainly not been the case. So for instance, if I look at last year, basically the Australian banking system has been a net repayer of debt offshore. So capital, when we look at it from the balance of payments point of view, capital is flowing out of the Australian banking system, mostly reflecting that change in the funding structure I was talking about. So the fact that they've raised more deposits and less short-term wholesale, a reasonable chunk of which was offshore, means that they've been a net repayer of debt. So notwithstanding that, the country still run a current account deficit, a smaller current account deficit in the past, and nevertheless still a current account deficit. So what's been the large capital inflow? It's actually been foreign purchases of Australian government debt, and in particular Australian Commonwealth government debt. So for instance, in the last few quarters of last year, net purchases of Australian government debt were about 3 or 4% to percentage points of GDP, 3 or 4% of GDP. So the current account at the moment is about 2% of GDP. So to some extent, you can say the Australian government's been funding the current account deficit, if you want to use that way of looking at things for the last few years. But again, I think that just reflects the fact that you've got two different things going on here. You've got capital flows, which are reflecting particular changes in investor preference. And then you've got the current account, which is which reflects developments in the real economy. And the thing which links the two of them is the exchange rate. And obviously, there's also an identity which says the two of them have to add up. Our estimate is that, it's not as reasonably precise. This one's actually a fairly precise estimate, is that offshore holdings of CGS in Australia are now up to around 75% of GDP. One thing which people tend to do, which is not the right way to do, is if you look at those capital flows, and I said they're about 4 percentage points of GDP, in the last quarter of last year, you can't just add that to the stock of foreign purchases of Australian government securities. It's a little more complicated than that. You need to actually look at, there's another statistical publication called the Financial Accounts, which is probably only for data nerds amongst you. But that actually gives you a better handle on all of that. So the stock, the foreign holdings of Australian government debt have been rising, but they're not up in the 80s, they're still in the mid-70s, probably up from the early low 70s a few years ago. From what we can work out, and we know about, as in fact, Morgan Stanley probably knows more about these flows than we do, because we, the central bank, don't see many of these flows across our books. A lot of them has been by sovereign asset managers. We're only picking this up from market liaison. We don't know this for a fact. But talking to people who intermediate these flows, including probably Morgan Stanley, that's the general sense we get, is that a large chunk of these purchases of government securities have been by sovereign asset managers. The other thing which is going on is that by and large, those guys buy CGS, and they tend not to buy state government paper, semis, or and certainly don't go further along, much further along the risk spectrum than that. So what that means is if you look at, say, the end of last year, CGS yields fell to a fairly low level. Semis, the spread of semis actually widened considerably, reflecting the fact that these buyers are buying one half of that equation, but not the other. That said, the state government debt yields, if you look at the absolute level of yields, were actually fairly low by historical standards. So they could still borrow relatively cheaply. It's just relative to the Commonwealth, that spread was considerably wider. So that does mean, as I said, there's a different investor participation in the CGS market compared to the semi market, and again, compared to the bank paper market, which means that those movements in spreads in some, to a reasonable extent reflect that, in fact, those markets aren't completely integrated. There are some people who are happy to arbitrage it, but there and there are some investors who are only going to play in one of those markets and not the other. So those, as I said, so the composition of the capital flows into Australia have changed. The other factor which is going on, obviously, is because there's a large investment boom going on and some very large investment projects, some of a reasonable chunk of which are not intermediated through the domestic banking sector. So the Australian banks have some role in financing those projects, but someone like a BHP can fund a fair chunk of his investment program just straight off its own book because it's got that much cash, or they're going to borrow directly from the global capital markets, as indeed both BHP and Rio have done in the past few months. And one thing which is interesting, when you look at those guys borrowing in the global capital market, so both BHP and Rio are rated below the Australian banking, four major Australian banks are in the around AA minus at the moment. BHP, I think, is single A, and Rio is somewhere around that, or potentially lower too. Both those two are borrowing considerably cheaper than the banks. So it's not surprising that they don't want to borrow, intermediate any of their investment spend through the banking system, because they can raise money a hell of a lot cheaper than the banks can, which again is a function of what's going on globally. If you look at large global corporates are able to raise money considerably cheaper than higher rated banks. So you guys are the investors, you can tell me why that's going on as to whether that's just, there's a big risk premium on the banking sector in particular, and or people aren't particularly confident in the rating agencies. Some combination of that, of the two. Anyhow, because those guys, so that also is affecting the composition of capital flows too. So they're financing some of this investment spend off their own books, which means it comes through in parts of the capital flows in terms of retained earnings or whatever, rather than seeing it come through the banking system. So as I said, the composition of capital flows have changed quite dramatically. That makes it difficult to work out what effect these investment decisions by, say, sovereign asset managers to buy more Australian government debt are having on the exchange rate. So if you look at the exchange rate relative to the terms of trade, it's probably somewhere in the right ballpark. But then if you look at the fact that the terms of trade look like they peaked in September and have declined since, but the exchange rate is a little off its highs now, but not a lot. Some of that is probably due to this increased purchase of Australian government debt, but as I said, it's difficult to get a handle on that because all these other capital flows are changing as well. So it's hard to say, just pick out one chunk of the capital flows into Australia and say that's what's driving the exchange rate. But nevertheless, there does seem to have been a bit of a portfolio shift by particularly sovereign investors towards Australian government debt. And that, obviously, ceteris paribus, that's going to put upward pressure on the exchange rate, because said it's difficult to know whether that's actually a valid assumption, given that the composition of all these capital flows are changing. So let me wrap up there. As I said, basically, I'm trying to give you an idea about what's happened in the chain, to the composition of bank funding in Australia, which has been, the predominant shift has been from an increase in deposit funding of about 10, 12 percentage points, decrease in short-term wholesale funding, an increase in maturity of long-term wholesale funding, some reasonable chunk of which is due to the fact that the banks are issuing covered bonds now, which tend to be more of 5 to 10 year maturity rather than sort of 3 to 5. That change in that change in funding has been associated with a rise in the cost of funding banks' books, about half of which, or more than half of which, has come from the deposit side of things, in particular competition for term deposits, and some chunk of which has come through from the long-term wholesale side of things. That shift in wholesale, that shift in the funding of the banking system has been mirrored in the, or been reflected in a shift in the capital flows in Australia. As I said, you know, that shift in composition of capital flows in Australia may have had some effect on the exchange rate, but I said that's a fairly difficult thing to determine given there's been such a marked shift in that composition. So let me finish there and happy to take questions that people want to ask.
By the issuance of covered bonds by the Australian Major Bank, represents a little bit of a change in the tiering of the capital structure.
Yep.
Is it fair to compare that to wholesale funding, or given that it is a secured asset, should it be considered closer in its comparison to senior?
No, that's right. It is a shift. The only point I was trying to make there is that the overall funding maturity of the books is larger because covered bonds have a larger maturity. So yes, you're right. Covered is obviously senior in the credit structure to unsecured funding, you can see it in the secondary market pricing at the moment, or even the primary market pricing. There's probably 30 basis point gap between covered and unsecured funding of the same maturity. Reflecting that seniority in the credit structure. That said, there is a cap on covered bond issuance, which effectively means they won't be able to issue more than about 6.5%. The actual cap's about 8, but because of, you know, one, they need to keep a buffer and whatever. So, and for a few other reasons, probably going to get up to around 6.5%. So while there is some subordination of the of the unsecured structure, it's not all that large in the general scheme of things, and particularly if you compare it to, say, European bank funding, or some European bank funding, where there's been a lot of covered bond issuance over the last 12-18 months, you're obviously a hell of a long way away from that sort of level of encumbrance of banks' balance sheets.
With regard to the funding of banks, as you said, you're about 1/8 of the book has been funded at higher rates, and unless deposit rates come down substantially, the average funding cost of the banks is going to go up as the year progresses. You said that basically the Reserve, by cutting cash rate by 50 bips, has sort of taken half of that 25 bip rise out of the funding rise in the last, I think, since you said the start of the financial year.
Yep.
Do you project forward what that funding pressure looks like,
yep,
when you sort of are setting your expectations to sort of get the end result, and then sort of once it goes through a 12.5 points, 15 points, you say it's time to sort of rebalance to that. You know, how does the tolerances work on that?
A few ways, points relevant to that. One, we can measure or estimate what's happening to funding costs to a reasonable degree of accuracy, but, you know, to the nearest 10 basis points, you know, which for 10 basis points when you're making a 25 basis point decision is, you know, it's a reasonable margin of error. But secondly, the idea that a particular quantum of change in funding costs automatically maps through to a particular change in lending rates is also difficult, right? I mean, it assumes there's some sort of predetermined magical margin for the banking system, which it must always be maintained. And so, you know, there's no, you know, so one of the factors which has gone on the deposit side has been competitive pressures, right? So whether that manifests itself in narrower margins or whether you're able to pass it all through to lending rates, that's different. You know, that's the decision that the banks, the private banks have to be taking, which we can't, which is difficult for us to actually forecast. So to some extent, and the other point, I suppose, also is that obviously we're not going to be able to calibrate things so finely, to be able to say, or to be confident in saying, well, our forecast is that funding costs are going to rise by 10 basis points over the next so many months that we're going to preempt that. That said, because a fair chunk of that rise has come from the term deposit book, that's already here and basically is already passed, washed through the whole term deposit book. So if you think about long-term wholesale, that's about 20-something percent of overall funding. And I said, and so you're talking about that, that rolls through, so it takes 3 or 4 years to roll through. So the amount you're seeing over any 6 month period is actually fairly small, notwithstanding the fact that it's gone up a fair bit. So that's a fairly slow moving feast. I said most of the short term movement on the funding side of things is going to come through from the deposit book. And we're certainly not able to forecast which way deposit competition is going to go, over the period ahead. So I said that, it's something, it's a factor, and it's just one of the factors which feeds into the board's decision every month. By certainly by no means is it the only one.
Guys, another question about deposits, and probably a couple of questions wrapped up in one. For those local banks that have built or bought offshore deposit businesses, are you seeing them bring back any deposits that are excess to the local needs back to Australia to fund here? Are the local regulators expressing any concerns to you about that? And when a deposit comes in from offshore, are you indifferent to whether it's an Australian deposit or a Thai deposit?
Those questions probably best addressed to APRA, not to me. I mean, so in the sense of have we had any, I mean, you're not, I mean, one, that's a fairly new phenomenon. I mean, beyond obviously the New Zealand businesses or NAB's Clydesdale business, but which they by and large, the Clydesdale business, I think, is broadly self-funding. So there's not deposit flow from one jurisdiction to another there. And that's also true for the New Zealand business. So you're really only talking about one reasonably new business by one of the banks in terms of the question you're asking. So we haven't seen a lot of that. Obviously, I don't know about, I can't answer the question about regulatory attitudes in other countries. I can't answer not because I won't tell you, because I just haven't heard any complaints around that. But if you look at the nature of some of the regulation out there at the moment, a lot of it is about ring fencing particular operations, so not looking at a lot of cross-border flows for the banking system. So obviously there are deposit flows go on across jurisdictions, particularly within the Asian region, but I suppose it's not that big a deal yet here that is has materially entered on the radar screen. It's something you're thinking about, something you're certainly thinking about, and as I said, probably something more for APRA rather than us.
Guy, you spent most of this on the funding side. Do you have any sense that the banks are restricting the availability of credit in a non-price way? In other words, is there any sense of a credit crunch in Australia for any class of borrowers?
I think well, we've got a financial stability review coming out later this week, which will directly well, we'll comment on that to some extent. I think, I mean, as has been well aware, there's been funding restrictions in the commercial property or non-price restrictions in the commercial property sector for a while. There's been, availability of credit hasn't been great there. That's still the case, but nothing really beyond that, I would say. Not on the housing side, not on, and if you look, I mean, if you look at the lending to large businesses, because a lot of those businesses are raising money directly, my guess is the banking system will be quite happy to lend more to them than they are currently. And that's certainly what they say in their regular market updates, that they're aiming to grow their large business lending book, but by and large that hasn't happened, in large part because those businesses, and particularly the ones who have access to global capital markets, are able to fund themselves a lot cheaper than going through the banking system. And that state of affairs, I think, may well persist for a while. So it's not a lack of availability of credit, it's the fact that those businesses are able to find cheaper credit somewhere else. Anyone else?
Can I ask a question? Granted that the cash rate is still the biggest driver, overall cost of funds for the end user, how do you ensure that
the margin expansion that the banks are picking up isn't over and above what they're seeing in the cost of funds. I mean, is that a responsibility or is that a concern of yours, and how would you monitor that situation, should it develop or restrict?
I mean, that's not something we have responsibility for. I mean, we're not after how the banks set their prices. We obviously take that into account in the setting of monetary policy. I mean, it's a valid enough discussion for the community to have, and the community is having that discussion. I think our main contribution to that is to at least provide some common ground for that discussion to happen, by providing information about what our estimate is of what's happening to funding and what our estimate is of what's happening to lending rates. Obviously, the banks publish every quarter what's happening to their margin, so you see the net outcome of that. And that's a valid enough discussion for the community to be having as to whether those margins are appropriate or not, but it's not something that we have any sort of responsibility for. As I said, the board's decision takes into account what's happening to the overall structure of lending rates and its determinations each month. But, you know, we're not after it's a discussion for the community to have is what's the appropriate margin, or more generally, what's the appropriate profitability of the banking system, not ours.
Guy, just on employment trends, looking at the mix of both full-time and part-time, the way in which employment by sector has moved within the economy, and appreciate the RBA looks at it in aggregate, but you sat back 2 years ago as with the macro dynamics in terms of trade and what's happening with the resources side. Are there any surprises or non-surprises in what you've seen in the employment trends that you would have not predicted 2 years ago? Or is it about what the RBA would have expected?
You're starting to stray away from my prime area of expertise here, but a fair chunk of the strength in employment's been in the services sector, which is not so surprising, particularly the non-traded side of the services sector. I think manufacturing employment, at least as measured, is actually not done as badly as you would have expected or would believe reading the newspaper. Retail has, I'd say, but there's a few different things going on in the retail sector, including, you know, exchange rate obviously matters, but also I think there's other pressures on the whole retailing business model, which would be happening regardless of where the exchange rate was. Mining sector employment has grown. That's not a surprise. And if you look at where the employment has been, growth has been on a regional basis, that's also been broadly what you would have expected given the economic conjuncture.
Guy, just a quick question on the currency, which you mentioned.
A couple of points, I suppose, just in relation to the terms of trade comment you made earlier and the fact that the currency has obviously remained pretty high in spite of the fact that you think terms of trade have maybe peaked at the back end of last year. And also the fact that there's a lot of talk now in the popular press just about the impact that the high Aussie dollar is having on local industry and the like. Is there any stage that you or the bank get concerned about the level of the TWI or maybe the Aussie dollar, notwithstanding, you know, limited number of tools to be able to deal with it?
I mean, the exchange rate is one of the things which factors into the economic assessment each month, clearly. And certainly, you know, it's having a material influence on the economic outlook at the moment. And so, you know, at the moment, basically looking at weighing out the, you know, offsetting impacts of the boost that's coming from the terms of trade and the associated investment spend, and on the one hand, and the fact that the exchange rate's high in large part because of that, and the effect that's having on the non-traded sector. So you've got these two forces, pretty large forces actually, pulling in opposite directions and trying to calibrate the monetary response to the net balance of those. And with the aim of trying to at least, you know, achieve broadly balance. which obviously is not going to happen every quarter throughout the year. But so as I said, it's something which factors materially into the assessment of the stance of monetary policy. It's difficult to be that confident about where, you know, to make it. So the exchange rate is in the ballpark of where you would expect given the rise in the terms of trade. So be able to calibrate and say, well, the terms of trade off, I think it was 6-7% in the last quarter, probably gone sideways in this quarter, commodity prices are stabilized. You know, whether that means that the exchange rate should be 6% off the peak it reached, or whether the peak, what, you know, those things are exactly calibrated. So that it makes those sort of assessments somewhat difficult. But not that said, obviously you have to take, the exchange rate is taken account of in the board's deliberations each month, and is a reasonably important input into those assessments. Andrew?
Offshore sovereign holding of Australian government CGS is about 75% of GDP.
Offshore holding. Yep.
That's good for the moment, but what are the risks associated with that? I mean, it's been a good outcome for now, but that's pretty high across the industrialised world. What's the downside, possible downsides?
It's high. One reason it's high across the industrialised world is because the outstanding stock of debt to GDP here is low. So if you look at it, if you looked at that number as a share of GDP, my guess is that's not that high. So it's high as a share of the outstanding stock. It's not, but because the stock is low as a share of GDP, not so high. I think there are two flows been going on actually in terms of CGS. One is Japanese retail, I think, is back in the market. They'd got to a point where they were quite happy with their level of holdings of Australian government debt, went out and looked at a few other opportunities like in Turkey or South Africa, say, then decided that actually they might buy a bit more Australian government debt. And that's been happening, I think, over the course of this past 3 months or so. Those guys are actually pretty, at least when it comes to Australia, they're pretty sticky investors. They buy, you know, their decision to buy or not is affected, in fact, a reasonable chunk by the exchange rate, but they don't sell their holdings down in a hurry, at least they haven't done so traditionally. In terms of those sovereign asset managers, again, I'd say a lot of those guys are buy and hold investors, who don't tend to change their mandates that quickly. One implication it does have, though, is to the extent they buy and hold and don't lend those securities back into the market, it can make the liquidity in the market here tighter than it might otherwise be. And that's something we have to take account of, particularly with the liquidity rules coming down the pipe. And that's something we are taking into account. So I'm not. If your point was, are these guys going to turn around and flee in a hurry? I'm not so sure that's the case. I think these guys, those mandates change pretty slowly, and I'm not sure that they're going to change in a dramatic hurry, given the outlook, the history and the outlook for Australia. And the other way, so just one more thing on that. The other way to think about it is, if you think of some of the large sovereign asset managers, if they allocate one percentage point more to Australia, not a big deal for them, big deal for us in terms of capital flows. So it's a small decision for them, disproportionately large impact for us.
What's the board's position towards the long-term sustainability of the current account deficit?
I can't answer what the board's position is. You have to ask the board.
They generally don't know.
And I've spoke about the current account for a while in the past. I mean, if you look at where we are at the moment, the current account's about a couple of percentage points of GDP. The stock of external liabilities has broadly gone sideways for the last quite some time now. And the reason why we are where we are at the moment is that, savings has gone up a lot in the economy, but investments that are the highest it's ever been in the country's history, at least measured history. which is a different, you know, sort of configuration. So the, and the other point, I suppose, is that we've had large swings in the current account, which haven't been that disruptive. They've been accompanied by large swings in the exchange rate, but by and large, the economy's been able to adjust to them pretty well. I mean, mid-80s, early, you know, 2000, there have been large swings. And so the other thing is, I sort of look at it as a net of some pretty large forces. And ultimately, the current account, I think, is a residual. So you can look at what factors are which are driving that, and you can be worried about them or not. But to sort of focus on the current account in and of itself, I think, you have to go one step back and say, why is it where it is? And should I be concerned about that rather than just looking at it in and of itself?